The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's Trump's Trials and Tribulations New York Trial Dispatch, April 23rd. I'm Benjamin Wittes, with Tyler McBrien and Anna Bauer discussing the first criminal case to go to trial against former President Trump. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Trump Trials and Tribulations New York Trial Dispatch. It's April 23rd. I'm Benjamin Wittes in the Hammock Studio, not wearing a dog shirt, wearing a guinea pig shirt. And I am here with Anna Bauer and Tyler McBrien, both joining from the Lawfare New York Content House, fresh from a day of, it sounds like, fireworks in New York's Supreme Court. So let's catch up on the line situation first. Tyler, Anna, what happened in the line today?
Well, I can speak to the line for the general press. It was pretty calm, orderly. Quite a few members of the public got in as well. There was one man dressed like a dashing cowboy, I would say. He had fringes on his jacket, a cowboy hat. But the story there, I think, is that also there was a member of the public, at least in my courtroom, who was detained at one point early on because he was being quite disruptive and not listening to court directions. So let that be a lesson to anyone who wants to come in from the public that there's no nonsense in there, and you will be detained if you continue to disrupt.
What did detention involve? Was it like Guantanamo, or was he released on his own recognizance? Was he charged with anything?
There was no hood put over his head that I saw, but I did hear that he was taken out of the courtroom. I'm not sure what became of him after that.
Summary execution. Anna, what were your atmospheric experiences?
Yeah, today was actually great. I showed up at 8 o'clock to get into the reserve press line, and immediately, like 10 minutes later, we started going into court.
Nature is healing.
I know, right? But some people have asked about this, so maybe I should just explain why Tyler and I are in different lines. There are 54 or 58 media organizations that have reserved seats in the courtroom itself, but then there's also an overflow room.
So wait, I just want to emphasize this to people. Does Lawfare have a reserved seat inside the courtroom?
Yes.
Yeah, and how did we get that?
It's a long story.
No. I just want you to say it's because we're so cool and we provide such a valuable service, that the court, felt it was important for us to be in the room, right?
Obviously. Okay. Well, the real story is a very long story that I don't think anyone wants to actually hear. But we do have a reserve seat in the courtroom, because we are so cool and good at our jobs. And for that reason, I was able to show up at like 8 o'clock. Tyler was over in the overflow line, and the reserve press line is just very chill now. Everyone's, I think, we're falling into the trial pattern, and the excitement has kind of died down. Although I will say one of the main issues for the press in the courtroom is the internet service is really bad there, even if you have a hotspot. And something that I didn't really appreciate until recently is that, you know, it might get better at some points of the day than others, because when Trump is on the move, apparently one of the things that they do is like jam the signals for cell service. So that's something that I personally did not know that another reporter was telling me about today in the courtroom. So hopefully that explains why, especially at the beginning of hearings, sometimes my internet service and live tweeting is a little bit slower than it usually is.
There you go. All right. So it is now 9:30, and the first item on the agenda is the contempt hearing. So Tyler, what is this contempt hearing about? And it sounded like from your live tweets there were some fireworks during it.
Yeah, that's right. I had initially called it a bit like watching a car wreck, which I liken to a fender bender, and I immediately upgraded it to a train wreck as the fireworks went on. But this is in with regards to a April 1st gag order clarification and expansion ordered by Justice Merchan and Trump's alleged 10 violations of it in tweeting, mostly about posts. So 8 of them were Truth Social posts, and 2 of them were, I believe, things that he had posted on his campaign website regarding witnesses, so Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen. And essentially the hearing, we went through these exhibits one by one, and the prosecution argued why they were in violation of the gag order, and they were asking for sanctions. They were asking for the maximum sanctions for Merchan to impose under New York state law. That is, I believe, $1,000 per violation, or up to 30 days in jail. And yeah, I'll let Anna take over from here. But there was one moment that it got so bad that Justice Merchan told Blanche that he's losing credibility in the courtroom. That's how I think egregious some of the arguments were on the side of the defense.
Yeah. So Anna, for those of us who weren't present but are really eager to rubberneck, to use a New York term, what tell us about the train wreck that we all slowed down to watch.
Yeah. Okay. So you, just for context, one of the arguments that Trump's team was trying to make here is that these posts on Truth Social, and many of them were reposts, you know, for example, a New York Post article that had content in it that probably would certainly violate the gag order if it was something that Trump himself had been posting. And so as a part of their argument, Todd Blanche was arguing first that, well, a repost itself cannot be a violation of the gag order. But then second, he made this like very odd argument in which he said there basically, you know, there were things that Trump had reposted before or posts that he had made previously that the prosecution did not move to hold him in contempt for. And so therefore, because those posts went out without consequence, it meant that Trump could not have in the future had a willful violation because he basically had not faced consequence before. And so he thought he won it again and that it was fine.
So so that's I killed 3 people and you didn't prosecute me for murder.
Yeah.
Therefore, it's lawful for me to kill the 4th.
That's the argument. Effectively.
Yeah, and I would say Justice Merchan had the exact same tone when he tried to recite that argument back to Blanche. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so, and his response was, his response was basically, what are you even, why are you, I can't believe you're arguing.
It's kind
this,
of like an,
you know,
adverse possession theory of gag order violations, right? If you live in the if you squat in the apartment blatantly over a long period of time, it becomes yours. And this is like, if I violate this gag order blatantly often enough, then you can't hold me in contempt for violating it ever.
Right. And so that was what really, I think, set Justice Merchan off, is because this is the argument that Blanche kept making over and over and over again, that Merchan thought was told. He said this is not probative, you know, whether or not there are things that have towed the line in the past and weren't enforced is simply not probative of anything related to the willfulness of these alleged violations. And so then as Blanche continued to push these different, this kind of theory, at one point, that's where, as Tyler said, Justice Mershon just got really frustrated and said, you know, you're losing, I'm telling you right now, you are losing all credibility with the court. And that's just something that it's truly the worst words that any attorney can hear, especially at the very beginning of the trial. So we're on, you know, we're on day two of the substance of the proceedings and the judge is saying you're losing all credibility with the court. It's just not, it's not what a defense attorney wants to hear. And so ultimately Justice Mershon said that he would, you know, reserve ruling and, you know, take into account the arguments and that he would rule later. I don't think, Tyler, we got a time frame for that decision. Am I correct about that?
Correct. And I'll just add a bit more context around the credibility comment. I believe this was shortly after he was clarifying the reposting argument. And Mershon kept asking, what is the mechanism for a repost? He was essentially asking, it's not a passive thing. You know, he said, you know, Trump had to sit there, use quotation marks and the shift key, especially with regard to the Jesse Waters example, which was, he called a hybrid post where he reposted some of it and he added some of his own.
And what is this example? As well.
This example was a segment that was on Jesse Waters' Fox News show in which he went, I think, juror by juror and gave information about each of the jurors and then said something to the effect of that there are, it's, you know, they're lying to liberal activists or something are lying to the judge to get onto the jury. And then at that point, Blanche was then trying to end the entire hearing on the point that that they're trying to comply with the gag order and that Trump is, quote, being very careful. That was the point at which the judge cut in and said, you're losing all credibility, I'll tell you right now. Because it just after the entire, you know, proceeding.
You can accuse Trump of many, many things, but being careful is really not one of them.
Right.
So he doesn't rule on this. And my impression is that I would be shocked if he ordered Trump jailed on a first violation of this gag order. Do you guys have any reason to think that is more likely than I do?
I think you're right about that. And also, I don't think that the prosecution asked as a potential sanction for him to be jailed. They asked for
sort of modest financial stuff, right?
Well, yeah, but it's actually, it is modest, but it's actually I think it's the maximum. Is that right? Is that right, Tyler? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And then they also asked for him to be, you know, admonished and that he should remove the post that violated the gag order, but they did not specifically ask for him to be jailed.
I'd also add, they also asked for the gag order to be expanded to include members of the jury, also as an expansion of the anonymous jury order.
Interesting. So I would imagine that Justice Mershon will rule on this quite promptly, just on, is there any reason to doubt that?
No, there's no reason to doubt that. I will add one more thing as well that came up. They mentioned, you know, that yesterday after court, Trump went out and made statements about Michael Cohen, who is almost certainly going to be a witness in the case, and that is well known. Trump went out and kind of, you know, attacked the credibility of Michael Cohen. And the prosecution brought up the fact that that would constitute another alleged violation. And they said that they would be moving, even though that violation was not, alleged violation was not included in their previous motion for contempt, they indicated that they would be filing an additional, you know, motion for contempt or supplement. I'm not sure which one, but based on that alleged violation that occurred yesterday after court.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger. Feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And I noted Christopher Conroy's quote at that point, because he seemed to really emphasize how brazen it was. He said, talking about this alleged 11th violation, he said, quote, "For the record, yesterday here in this building, right outside those doors, the defendant violated the order on camera. He did it right here in the hallway outside."
Yeah, I was there for that. Or at least if it was in the morning, I was. And yeah, I didn't hear his afternoon rant. Let's pause a minute over the prosecution. Usually, as a good rule of thumb in court, that when you're the opponent, your opposing side is self-immolating in front of, maybe we shouldn't use self-immolation jokes in this trial, because of what happened the other day. Sorry about that. When your opponent is engaged in self-destructive activity in front of with the judge, you sit on your hands and shut up and just let it go on as long as possible. What was the prosecution's tack during this hearing?
Go ahead, Tyler.
I was just going to say, one element of this that I think was really easy for them to prove was, you know, they also had to, it seemed like, prove that these violations were willful and in full knowledge of the gag order. And I think that made the prosecution's job a lot easier when the defendant is tweeting, "I've been gagged," or "gag order" in all caps. So I'll just put that point out there first.
Well, and they also, Tyler, you might have the exact language of the Truth Social post in front of you, but they also at the very end, they basically been, you know, after they set out their arguments, they kind of elaborated on, here's all of the different violations and how they violated the gag order, and here's why we know it was willful and knowing, and they kind of brought up exactly what Tyler just said about Trump's, all of his tweets in which he's been tweeting about the gag order. But then at the very end, after, you know, Blanche's kind of disastrous moment at the lectern and the credibility comment, one of the prosecutors got back up and said, "I did want to just draw your honor's attention to, you know, the fact that we know what Trump knows about the effect that his Truth Social posts have, or kind of what their, you know, import is, because he has previously truthed about, you know, when he's been truthing about how great Truth Social is and stuff, he has this like truth that he wrote in a post where he's kind of saying something along the lines of, whenever I send out a truth, like everyone is listening," or something to that effect. So Tyler, I don't know if you have it exactly, but it was interesting because they, you know, that's how they kind of followed up. But other than that, they did seem to let their opponents just kind of, veer off course in the way that they
right.
did.
Let us turn to the continued testimony of Mr. David Pecker. One of my great regrets in life will be that I missed some of his testimony, because as I said yesterday, I could not love him more. And so Tyler, give me a sense of what did I miss today? David Pecker back on the stand. How far did we get and what did he talk about?
So one thing you did not miss was one of his signature laughs. Unfortunately, he had no occasion to laugh, so I couldn't weigh your impression, whether it was accurate or not. And I couldn't enjoy it for myself firsthand. But we got a lot of the story from Pecker. So we learned pretty in depth how some of these catch and kill schemes worked. Well, first, sorry, I should back up. We got some confirmation, I would say, about the August 15th, 2015 meeting at Trump Tower between himself, Michael Cohen, Trump, and for a short period of time, Hope Hicks, in which this catch and kill scheme was hatched. It was not a written agreement. It was an agreement among friends, I think Pecker called it. And then from there, we heard of how a few of these schemes actually happened in practice. So we heard about how this happened with the Karen McDougal story, with the alleged out-of-wedlock child-rearing story from the doorman, and it was interesting. I'll let Anna talk about the objection that Bove raised, that we started to get some of the underlying conspiracy information here, but we went through emails, invoices. We saw up close what one of these source agreements looks like. So this was the source agreement between AMI, the publisher, and the doorman, Dino. I'm blanking on his last name, but so Juden, thank you. How this was an atypical sum because of how important it was, how embarrassing Pecker thought it would be to Trump and the campaign. We also learned that Cohen was Pecker's main point of. Well, we also had confirmed that Cohen was Pecker's main point of contact, and it, with the McDougal story in particular, he was seemingly under a lot of pressure from Trump to get a resolution from the McDougal story in particular. And we also learned at one point that Pecker and Trump himself spoke on the phone about the catch and kill scheme. Trump, and I'll let Anna clarify this, but I think what was said was that Trump said that he said, quote, "I don't buy stories because the act of buying the stories will eventually get out." And that's something that he didn't want to get out. But Anna, I'll kick it to you to fill in the gaps there.
Yeah, I will say, Ben, I think you would have loved some of the details today that Mr. Pecker gave us in with respect to the journalism practices within the tabloid industry.
Because were there any great phrases like checkbook journalism?
Well, go ahead, Tyler.
I was going to say one phrase that was very interesting to me was his use of marketplace. He kept saying that these stories were on the market and he wanted to take them off the market, like everyone engages in this checkbook journalism, and that there's this vast marketplace out there. And it's almost like there's an invisible hand guiding it all. And if a story's out there, he wants to take it off the market. And that's the only reason, to cut in.
Yeah, like, for example, Ben, he talked about how, when they're trying to figure out whether they want to buy a story for an exclusive, they will vet the story by giving the source a polygraph test. And
that's how we do it at Lawfare. Whenever somebody submits an article, we're like, it looks good, but we're gonna give you a polygraph on this.
Yeah, I'm hooked up to a polygraph right now.
Yeah. And so then, he wasn't permitted to say what the results of the polygraph were in the case of the Dino Sajudin story, in which Dino Sajudin had alleged that Trump had, had an illegitimate child with a former employee. But so he talked about that. He also talked about how, as a part of the catch and kill scheme, the broader scheme of, this agreement between AMI, David Pecker, and then the Trump campaign through Michael Cohen and Trump, when they were publishing negative stories about people in the National Enquirer, there were these questions about, like, well, how would that happen? And he said, basically, Michael Cohen would come to him and say, hey, we want to run a negative story about Ted Cruz or Marco Rubio or Ben Carson. And then David Pecker said, and so then I would just get the information from Cohen and embellish it. And it was just
also consistent with how we do things at Lawfare. You know, Anna comes to me and says, here's what's happened in court. And then I say, great. And then I embellish it. And that's how we do shit at Lawfare.
Yeah, so it was just a totally wild look at the world of checkbook journalism, as David Pecker called it. But beyond that, another thing that we kind of learned today that is very substantive in terms of the prosecution's theory of the case came up when they were talking about these, you know, placement of negative pieces in the National Enquirer. And as a part of this line of questioning, the prosecution started asking Pecker if he knew Steve Bannon. And as a part of that questioning, you know, Pecker said, yes, I know Steve Bannon. At one point, I had a conversation with Trump, and he said that, you know, Steve Bannon had liked the pieces that we'd been putting out, and he had some ideas. And so as a result, Pecker sent Bannon a number of negative stories about Hillary Clinton that they'd run before. And then the prosecution started trying to elicit questions about whether Steve Bannon had ever specifically directed or asked Pecker to place negative stories in the National Enquirer. And before that question could be responded to, there was an objection.
Seems like a hearsay objection, right?
Yeah, it's a hearsay objection. And so then there's a lengthy sidebar, and then eventually Marchand takes everyone out of the room, takes the jury out of the room, and then we all come back in to have argument over it because it seems like there was just no clear resolution. And so then we had an on-the-record argument that the jury was not in the room for. And as a part of that argument, the defense was arguing hearsay and that the whole line of questioning about Steve Bannon and various conversations that he had with Pecker would be hearsay as well. The prosecution, I think, you know, part of their argument is that it's a hearsay that would be elicited, you know, even though Bannon is not, you know, alleged as a co-conspirator in the indictment, they're saying, which would be, you know, an exception to a hearsay rule because, you know, a statement's by a co-conspirator. But the prosecution was trying to say, like, you know, even though there's not a conspiracy alleged in the indictment, there is a conspiracy that is a part of our underlying case because we have to prove this, you know, that the falsification of business records occurred with an intent to defraud, which included an intent to conceal or aid another crime. And that object crime, as it's called in New York, the prosecution could put forward the theory under this New York state law provision in that criminalizes a conspiracy to, you know, promote a candidate to election through unlawful means. And so it seemed that, you know, the prosecution was really kind of referencing this New York state election law as the object crime in a very specific way that they have referenced in filings, but it's always been kind of unclear if that maybe would be the primary, you know, theory of the case, because there's also the FEC, you know, campaign finance theory. There's the tax law theory. But the way that they were discussing it really seemed to indicate that maybe their main theory of the case that they're going to be putting forward is this, you know, New York state election law that criminalizes a conspiracy to promote candidacy through unlawful means. So that was very interesting.
Assumed they will argue all three of them and see what sticks.
Yes, and I think that Justice Marchand specifically pointed that out, that he has given them permission to argue all three of those theories, but it just seemed to be the way that the prosecution was talking about this specific conspiracy theory, the way that it has been kind of portrayed as well in terms of the opening statements. It all seems to be pointing towards, you know, they seem to be putting a lot into that particular theory as opposed to, and, you know, really emphasizing the conspiracy element as opposed to just the, you know, tax or the campaign finance things. But those two things also relate to the conspiracy thing because, So anyway, that was an interesting part of something that came up during the hearsay objection. Ultimately, the ruling was that, although actually, did he say that he needed to look at some case law, Tyler?
I think so. And then I would just add quickly the other two things that the defense argued were that the government didn't give them notice that they would be talking about Bannon with regard to the conspiracy. And then they also said, but it doesn't matter anyway, because this is just, you know, campaign staff doing normal campaign work.
Because, again, Lawfare is effectively run by the campaigns we cover. You know, we always get the fixers for the campaigns always suggest headlines and for us and, you know, do the work. So that's how we work. And so it shouldn't be surprising that the National Enquirer does the same thing. Highest journalistic traditions. Anna Bauer, Tyler McBrien, thank you for joining us today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.